Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Tep An was a teenager in 1975. Like most Cambodians, she was moved to the countryside and forced into backbreaking work at a labor camp.
Las Vegas, Sin City, and a mecca for circus artists. It attracts extraordinary talent from around the world, especially from Russia, where gymnasts and acrobats are rock stars.
Sudan is Africa's largest country. But after 22 years of civil war, Sudan is no more.
All I know is Khartoum. I've never lived in the south.
I'm Jake Schoniker.
I'm Faye Abulgasim.
I'm Lauren Rosenfeld.
I'm Ted Troutman.
I'm Camila McDonald.
And I'm Brian Gibble. Those stories and more on CNS News.
For decades, Cambodians have sought justice for the millions of lives lost during the genocidal reign of the Khmer Rouge. Now, more than 30 years later, a UN-sponsored tribunal is bringing four top Khmer Rouge leaders to justice and educating the next generation of Cambodians about their country's tragic past. Cambodia is a land in transition, emerging from a violent past. In the late 1970s, a quarter of the population was killed by the Khmer Rouge. Now a new generation is coming of age and helping to rebuild this war-torn country. I came to Cambodia to find out how survivors of the genocide are confronting their former oppressors and passing the lessons of the past to the youth who will decide Cambodia's future. Walking through a typical market like this one, I find elder Cambodians going about their daily lives, selling almonds and fruit. But behind every gentle gaze is a story of loss from the genocide. Tep An was a teenager in 1975 when Khmer Rouge forces led by Pol Pot took control of the country. Like most Cambodians, she was moved to the countryside and forced into backbreaking work at a labor camp. This forced labor was part of the Khmer Rouge vision for an agrarian communist society. Those who were educated, teachers, doctors, lawyers, were targeted and killed. In less than 4 years, nearly 2 million Cambodians died of starvation, disease, or execution. An herself lost 10 family members to the regime's brutality and paranoia. She says her father was probably killed here, at the Chung Ek killing fields. Thousands were killed here and dumped into mass graves. Now it's one of Phnom Penh's biggest tourist attractions. This man knows the killing fields well. His name is Him Hoi, and he's a former Khmer Rouge prison guard. Hoi worked here at Phnom Penh's notorious Toll Slang prison, also known as S21. Thousands of prisoners were tortured and interrogated here before being sent to the killing fields for execution. Chum Mei is one of a handful of prisoners who survived S21. On this day, Mei came back to the place he was tortured to meet his friend Samrati. Rati is also a survivor, held in a Khmer Rouge prison on the other side of the country. Their shared experience has brought them together.
ayah ni, tapi ayah cuai tak kenal. Cuai tak kenal, tapi kong ayah cuai kelahat. Cuai kelahat, tapi ayah yang lelah tak sah. Yang baik ni apa? Pin nak, cuai pin nak, yuk. Aku nak yang berhal yang berhal, dia tak mahal ni. Dia tak nak pin ni.
The Khmer Rouge was meticulous in documenting those who passed through here. Every prisoner was photographed, women, children, the young and the old. Their faces serve as a reminder of the horror that ripped the nation apart. Were these terrified people really enemies of the state? Why would Cambodians slaughter their own people? These unanswered questions still haunt this shattered nation, as its people struggle to understand.
The whole nation is broken. You know, when you drop a glass on the floor, it's broken. Our job, to pick all these broken pieces, and sometimes you got cut and bleeding, and put all this back together, knowing that it will never be the same.
If there's one man in Cambodia who can begin to understand the country's violent past, it's Yuk Chang. In 1995, he founded the Documentation Center of Cambodia. Since then, he's compiled thousands of photographs, documents, and testimony from both victims and perpetrators, including this photo of the prison guard I met.
This picture of him, boy, is him. No, he was 26, 27.
These photographs and documents have helped provide a picture of the past, and now they're helping to bring the Khmer Rouge leaders to justice.
So we'll be bringing forward policy documents from the Khmer Rouge leaders to show that these crimes that occurred across the country didn't occur just by coincidence.
William Smith is the co-deputy prosecutor for the UN-backed Khmer Rouge Tribunal. After more than 30 years, Cambodians are getting their first taste of justice. The Khmer Rouge commander, Pol Pot, died in 1998. But this June, four of the highest-ranking Khmer Rouge leaders will be brought to trial and made to answer for their alleged crimes against humanity. Nun Chia, known as Brother Number Two, he was second in command only to Pol Pot. Ing Tarit, Pol Pot's sister-in-law and minister of social action for the Khmer Rouge. Her husband, Ing Sari, deputy prime minister of the regime. And Kusum Pan, who served as head of state for the Khmer Rouge.
These four accused were the designers of these policies, the designers of this revolution, the designers of these methods in which these crimes were carried out.
Last year, the tribunal handed down its first sentence to Kangak Eve, also known as Doik. He was the strong-armed chief of the Tolslang prison I'd visited, and Him Hoi's boss. During the trial, Doik admitted responsibility for killing more than 12,000 people at the Tolslang prison. The four leaders on trial this summer haven't admitted to anything, but there are more than 2,000 witnesses who've lined up to testify against them. In advance of the trial, these witnesses are already preparing for the proceedings. Hundreds of them gathered here in Kampong Chinang province. Many traveled hundreds of miles to hear from their lawyers. Many survivors urged the court to prosecute a wider circle of the Khmer Rouge cadre, beyond the four top leaders. But in a country where many of the former Khmer Rouge have gone on to take positions in government, Cambodia's leaders have made it clear that won't happen, including the local governor here. Many survivors fear that those who killed and committed crimes during the regime, who terrorized their families, will never be brought to justice. But what about people like Him Hoi, who say they were forced to commit crimes, forced to kill people out of fear? Where does the line between killer and victim get drawn? With so many victims living side by side with their former Khmer Rouge oppressors, the deep wounds that divide this country may never be reconciled. But the tribunal is providing a chance for Cambodians to understand what happened and start moving on with their lives. After years of government censorship in classrooms, the history of the Khmer Rouge genocide is now part of the national curriculum. And in the months leading up to the trial, officers with the court have been traveling to schools across the country, reaching out to students. At one of the largest high schools in Phnom Penh, 5,000 students listened and took notes during the history lesson. Reach Sambat is a public affairs officer with the court.
They are brilliant. They ask us a lot of questions about what we were doing. And when we ask them questions, they could answer even the tough questions.
For survivors like Sumrati and Chamme, the tribunal will not bring back lost loved ones or heal the scars they still carry. But the court is an opportunity to seek justice and to share their stories with the next generation. Hearing young Cambodians and old survivors talk about their country's future underlines the true impact of the trial. It's expected to take at least 3 to 5 years for the trial to finish, and this may be the last case that the court pursues. But despite its complications, the tribunal is bringing to light and helping to resolve the country's unanswered questions. And after 30 long years, helping survivors and the entire country to heal.
Our next story on Sudan is not about Darfur. While the world focused on ethnic violence in the West, Sudan's north and south made a big step towards peace. An agreement signed in 2005 ended 2 decades of civil war, and in January, the largely Christian south voted to separate from the Muslim north, leaving large segments of the population in limbo.
Sudan is Africa's largest country, but after 22 years of civil war, Sudan is no more. In Khartoum, people are readying themselves for the inevitable. The 10th largest country in the world split into two when South Sudan voted to secede.
The referendum came as part of a deal for self-determination designed to achieve peace, whether in unity or in separation.
The capital, Khartoum, is where the Blue Nile and White Nile meet. In the early 80s, a hardline Muslim government imposed traditional Sharia law. Approximately a third of the country, the black majority Christian South, rebelled. In January, 98% of South Sudanese voted to secede. The election went smoothly. But not every South Sudanese had a chance to vote. 2 million of them live in the north, and fewer than 8% of those registered to vote. Joy Burrow was among those who could not take part.
I know I have missed out on one of the, you know, a life-changing, a pivoting occurrence of the history of Sudan.
The rules of the referendum prohibited any South Sudanese born after 1959 from voting in the north. So Joy and many in her generation were left out. And there were allegations that South Sudanese with Arabic names were not allowed to vote, even though the election affects their future too.
Never, ما حصل. نحنا أبدا ما حصل. نحنا عندنا في هذا المركز عندنا حوالي كم 40 شخص أسماء عربية وسجلوا من أصول جنوبية. القانون واضح واللوائح واضحة.
Many neighborhoods, like this one in the capital of Khartoum, have been vacated by thousands of South Sudanese heading south. But for many, Khartoum is the only home they know.
All I know is Khartoum. I've never lived in the south.
Along with thousands of South Sudanese, Joy's family fled to the north when in 1983, ethnic and religious tensions boiled over. 2 million South Sudanese died in the ensuing violence. The country has been in turmoil ever since its independence in 1956. While independence was desirable, it also provoked the long-standing tensions among the ancient tribes competing for power in Sudan.
Africa as a whole, as a continent, is still tribal. So diversity is the common factor in many, many African countries.
A 2005 peace treaty called for an election to decide whether Sudan would remain whole or split into two.
This was designed as part of a comprehensive peace agreement reached back in 2005, January, signed in Nairobi between the two parties, and have been implemented since then. And it is climax in the present referendum.
Reporters flocked from all over the world to cover this historic election. Despite the overwhelming approval for secession, there are still complications for South Sudanese living in the north.
My parents grew up here in the north. I have many family members of my family who live here also. But then again, when I go down to the south, obviously, you know, it's completely different culture-wise, society, and it's a place where I feel a bit, you know, slightly more free than I do here. But at the same time, it's still a foreign place.
Joy's family is from the south, but she was born in the north and raised in England. She's now studying medicine in Khartoum. Her dilemma is echoed by other South Sudanese whose loyalties are divided. Marcelo Igil is one. While Khartoum is a vibrant and growing city, the south is little more than an array of small, devastated villages. It's the size of Portugal and Spain together, but has only 40 miles of paved road. Mahjoub Saleh runs one of Sudan's biggest newspapers. After 60 years of reporting on his country's problems, he is worried the South is not ready to be a separate country.
The South has been a theater of war for the last 25 years. And all the infrastructures have been destroyed. And there is no chance of work and employment for these people. No services, not enough schools or hospitals, and not enough means of work to earn their living.
Joy Burrow agrees.
What I saw there was, it was tragic, really. No organization, and a lack of doctors.
الحكومة عملت على تقديم كل المساعدة اللازمة لعودة هؤلاء الناس من ناحية نقلهم توفير يعني وسائل للنقل.
أهي شفت الرئيس هنا.
عصمت عبد الرحمن is the chief of staff of the Northern Sudanese military. He says that oil is the most significant source of conflict between the north and south.
طبعا كما نعلم انه حكومه الجنوب تعتمد على النفط ودخل النفط بنسبه عاليه جدا تفوق 90% وبالتالي يستطيع ان تستغنى عنه.
The two areas are already fighting over the oil-rich region of Abyei, which will one day vote whether to join the north or the south.
We hope it will continue in peace. We hope it will bring peace about. But we have seen in other countries where such separation happened. People went back to war again after separation. This would be the worst scenario.
And there are signs that scenario could come true. There are fights over where the border should be and how citizenship issues like visas and passports will work.
The North feels sad that this is happening. And they have tried their best to convince the Southerners to opt for unity, but that did not materialize. So there is a disappointment. I think the two sides must be very flexible about the idea of citizenship for this. There must be a period of grace during which people will have to decide whether they want to belong to the north or the south.
Marcelo Igil could be one of those left in political, ethnic, and geographic limbo. Nevertheless, he cast his vote for separation.
Thank you, sir. See you later.
And despite the continuing turmoil in the south, Joy is considering returning there to help the new country get on its feet.
That kind of drove me to think about, you know, moving down there, because that's obviously I'm originally from there, and it would be a great help to society if, you know, more people would go back to the south and, you know, help out.
South Sudanese will celebrate their independence on July 9th amid fragile hopes that 22 years of civil war will finally be behind them.
Immigrants go to great lengths to stay in the United States. For some, their talent is their ticket to permanent residency. The Department of Homeland Security issues more than 40,000 extraordinary ability visas to unique individuals, like scientists, artists, and athletes. But in Las Vegas, many of those visas go to circus performers.
Las Vegas, Sin City, a mirage of neon lights in the middle of the Nevada desert, and a mecca for circus artists. It attracts extraordinary talent from around the world, especially from Russia, where gymnasts and acrobats are rock stars. And clowning is not just clowning. For Oleg Donilov, it's an art form.
Американская школа просто...
This is an American school.
And Russian, like... Это чувство.
There were a lot of feelings in it, in the Russian school.
Oleg is what the Russians call a musical clown. He and his wife Tatiana came to Las Vegas with the Russian Ice Show, which eventually closed.
But there is a saying, the circus left while the clowns stayed here.
But Oleg might have to leave America. His only hope is to qualify for an exceptional ability visa, a special provision for uniquely talented immigrants.
Hey guys, so
his immigration attorney helped him apply.
Right, so we submitted an application, we got a request for evidence, and we've responded to it. So, but what I want to do...
Oleg must convince immigration authorities that a clown of his caliber brings something valuable to the United States.
Now that you've shown exceptional ability, can you also show that your immigration is in the national interest? Mm-hmm. That the benefit that you will bring in to the United States will spread from east to west coast. It's going to be national in scope.
Oleg thinks he has what it takes.
Я могу помочь многим американским клоунам узнать, что такое музыкальная эксцентрика.
I can help a lot of Americans to become the more professional music eccentric.
И расширить их возможности.
And to expand their abilities.
Many Russians, like Igor Zaripov, have obtained this visa. He represents the best of a circus tradition that goes back more than two centuries.
I grew up in a circus in Russia, in circus family. I'm the fifth generation. We're circus family and we're based on horses. So we old generation was training horses. Me and my sister, the only one who left our tradition from horses and start to learn something new, explore something different. I decided to be an aerialist and my sister's a contortionist, so that's how I start to fly. I'm the aerial gymnast on straps, so basically I'm holding a rope. I pushed myself in the air and once I did it, I did a double twist. I mean, nobody in the world does it yet. I had to prove to America what I am, the one of the best in what I do.
To prove his extraordinary ability, Igor's attorney sent immigration authorities photos of him flying, his many awards, newspaper clippings, and expert testimony. His talent got him a green card.
You became a part of this country. You actually live here, and with a green card, it gives you opportunity to make a living easier.
Igor came to America on a temporary contract with a circus, but steady employment allowed him to put down roots in Las Vegas, where he met his wife Marina in a show.
In the show, like, we're supposed to fall in love, so in the act we fall in love, and actually we fall in love in the real life.
Here we are in the house, family, new baby,
Soon coming.
Happy. Hopefully when she delivered the child, we'll try to start work again together. So we'll see.
Igor may not be a rocket scientist or a Nobel Prize winner, but the U.S. government found his abilities exceptional enough to be in the national interest. Sergei Duman is a talented performer who did not get an extraordinary ability visa.
I fly in the air. I do the tricks in the air. I flip myself, do something crazy, finish it, and making the people happy.
Sergei holds the world record for the longest flying trapeze act, but that wasn't good enough for the U.S. government. He finally got a green card after marrying a U.S. citizen, and now he coaches gymnastics.
I was didn't thinking about that I gonna live in the United States. I was thought I gonna work my 2 years contract, make some money, and coming back at home. But I love United States. I love to live here. A little better. I stopped doing circus show because I wanna coaching kids. I have a friends performers from Russia. And them kids go on to my classes.
Don't fly away.
I would love to see them flying in the air. I would love to see them flip, you know.
Куда ты летишь вперед?
Give them what I love to do, what I used to do, you know.
For Dasha Shaminskaya, the green card she got by proving her extraordinary ability is an insurance policy. Without it, her injury could mean a one-way ticket back to Russia.
This woman right now, you know, I'm injured. I just had 2 shoulder surgeries. You realize one day, you know, you can continue doing this all your life. And it's really, really hard to even think about that because this is your passion. This is what you, you know, love doing.
But the injury has forced Dasha to think about life after the circus. A passion she's had since childhood.
That's how, you know, they find talent in Russia. They come to kindergarten and they look for kids. When they came, I was so happy. I was like, you know, I'm going to be a gymnast.
She decided to trade the bars for the trapeze, which got her to America and a job at Cirque du Soleil.
They basically offered me another contract doing aerial stuff here in Las Vegas for a Love Beatles show, and I said yes. Like, I didn't even think twice. I'm doing a contortion type of act on the rope. It's very calm, and it's involved for girls. There is no safety. There is no net under you, basically. It's just you and a rope.
No matter what happens to Dasha, her extraordinary ability visa will guarantee she gets to stay in Las Vegas. But Oleg is still in limbo.
If you have all legal papers and if you really mean something, you can live a brilliant life here.
But if Oleg doesn't qualify,
I'll say goodbye to America.
For the Russians who do manage to stay in Las Vegas, life is about more than tricks on a rope or ice skating in a clown costume. It's about bringing a proud tradition from one country to another, where the pay is better, the audiences are bigger, and the future often looks brighter.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.